Okay, so let's start with our motivation. So right now, we still have our precious human life that we worked very hard to obtain by creating incredible amount of virtuous karma in previous lives. And this precious human life affords us incredible circumstances that enable us to practice the Dharma and really dedicate our lives to the Dharma. But this opportunity is not going to last long, because this life is in the process, moment by moment, day by day, in ending, approaching death. And at the time of death, there's no opportunity to say, sorry, I'm not ready. Can I die later? There's still some things I want to do, like practice the Dharma. So that kind of situation won't arise while we're dying. So that means that whatever we want to do with our precious human life, however we want to make it meaningful in terms of practicing the Dharma, purifying our minds, gaining good qualities, then we have to do it now, and we have to do it consistently, not some days on and some days off. But if we can really put our mind into the Dharma practice like this, then our life takes on a whole different purpose, and we're no longer so concerned with what other people think about us, if we're measuring up to societal standards and expectations. So it frees us from all that kind of anxiety and worry, because we know exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it. And so what are we doing? We're trying to generate bodhicitta, the wisdom realizing emptiness. And why are we doing it? To attain full awakening, so we'll have the wisdom, compassion, and power to be of the greatest benefit to living beings. And so with that kind of motivation, then let's look at all these puzzling debate things. So if you look, the more clear our goals are in life, the more clear what we want to do and what the purpose of our life is, then the less anxious we're going to be about day-to-day matters. Because day-to-day matters usually have to do with the happiness of only this life, don't they? Yeah. Do I fit in? Do they like me? Am I equal to the other person? Am I better than the other person? Am I inferior to the other person? Yeah. How do I look? All this kind of stuff is so often the topic of our anxiety. When we're quite clear about the purpose that we're going towards, then we leave that stuff aside and we just are content to create the causes and do what we need to do and accept ourselves and keep going forward. Yeah, so life becomes much clearer, much more peaceful, I think. Okay, so that piece of paper that I couldn't find last week, I found. Okay, so just some, I want to give you, you know, some points to compare, see how you do. Because your whole reputation depends on this, you know. And you're standing in the monastery and what I think about you. Okay, so compare afflictions and non-virtuous mental factors. Is there something that's both an affliction and a non-virtuous mental factor? What? Yeah, anger. Okay. Is there something that is an affliction but is not a non-virtuous mental factor? So that means every affliction is non-virtuous?
You can be more specific. Can affliction be more specific? Craving for food?
Craving for food, that's an affliction, and that's also non-virtuous. So that's the first one. I'm saying, is there something that is an affliction but is not non-virtuous? So that means all afflictions are non-virtuous. Are all afflictions non-virtuous? No. What's an example? Yeah. Self-grasping. That's neutral. What's another one that's an affliction but not non-virtuous? Yeah? What?
Would love be considered an affliction but not?
No. Love's not an affliction. Love in a Buddhist sense, no.
Conceit of
love. No, that's non-virtuous.
No, I'm saying it's not, it's an affliction but not a non-virtuous mental factor.
Okay, but we're looking for something that's an affliction, and it's not non-virtuous.
So self-centeredness of the arhat.
That's not an affliction. Yeah, we just said ignorance. She said self-grasping ignorance. Okay, you go back and study and see if there's another one.
Yeah, but what about the five views?
Yeah.
So, the
wrong view isn't non-virtuous? That's non-virtuous. What about the other ones? That one's non-virtuous. Because it's holding on to wrong ideas. What's the first one? First view. So view of a personal identity, yeah, is a form of ignorance. It's not non-virtuous. It's also neutral. Okay. Is there something that is not an affliction but is non-virtuous?
Intending to harm somebody but not doing it.
Okay. Intending to harm somebody but not doing not doing that. Is that an affliction? Yeah. Hmm? Malice, yeah. Isn't malice an affliction? Yeah. So something that is not an affliction, but is non-virtuous. Yeah. 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 Their actions, their physical actions that are non-virtuous, the motivating factor in them is an affliction, but the action itself is not an affliction.
Comparing non-virtuous
mental. Oh, you're right. Yeah. Something that.
Killing is non-virtuous, but it's not an affliction.
Yeah, but it has to be a non-virtuous mental factor. Not just plain non-virtuous. Yeah. So is there something that is non-virtuous, but not is a non-virtuous mental factor, but is not an affliction?
How about having the intent or even the action of giving somebody something, but with a non-virtuous motivation.
Okay, we're talking about a non-virtuous mental factor.
Oh, mental factor, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think you could say that all non-virtuous mental factors are afflictions, yeah. If we didn't have mental factor there, you could point to some things that were non-virtuous, but not an affliction. And then is there something that is neither?
All virtuous mental factors?
Yeah. Virtue. Yeah. Virtuous mental factors. Okay.
So the idea of the personal identity was an affliction.
Yeah, the view of a personal identity is an affliction.
Not a non-virtuous mental factor.
But it's not non-virtuous mental factor. It's a neutral mental factor. Because it can arise also when we have virtuous minds. Or it can provoke a virtuous mind. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about what a mental factor exactly is. So if you have a specific example of attachment, for example, the thing I was saying, like craving for food, would that be a mental factor? Or
yes.
It's a mental factor. So
yes.
Every example of...
Every example of attachment is attachment. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We'll save some of these other ones for future. But it makes you think, and it tests to see how well you've really understood things.
So that's three possibilities?
Yeah. So we were on, I think, chapter 4 last time that was talking about the statements of qualities and chapter 5, statements of qualities and statements of pervasion. And so just to review some of that, because some people seem to be a bit puzzled last week. So let's see here. Okay, so with statements of qualities, yeah, the subjects are either a concrete singular term, which means a specific object, like your robe or his car or something like that, or it can be an abstract singular term, yeah, like a chair, but a chair doesn't refer to every chair. It's just an abstract singular noun. Okay, so it's not referring to a specific chair. Okay, so those are the subjects. So then also with statements of qualities, it's a collective a predication as opposed to a distributive predication. So these are big words, but you know, the idea behind them isn't so big. So a collective predication means that the predicate, the quality that is being ascribed to what the subject is, the predicate says something about the subject as a whole. So when it says collective predication, you know, it's a whole object. So his example, you know, is if somebody comes up and says, oh, I really like your house, you don't say, what part of my house do you really like? They're just saying your house, meaning the whole collective object. So when you're having a statement of qualities, you're just talking about the whole object, whatever is being stated as the object. Okay, so it's not a part of the object, it's not an example of the object. Okay, yeah, so the chair is an impermanent phenomena. Yeah, it's not talking about what part of the chair, just the chair in general. Yeah, the Congress is dysfunctional. Yeah, it's talking about the whole thing, not, you know, one part of it. Okay. whereas a distributive predication, and this is what's happening in statements of pervasion, but just to contrast the collective and distributive predications, the distributive predication is in it the predicate applies to each and every thing that is the subject. Okay. So there, usually, you would say something like, chairs are impermanent phenomena, and everything would apply to each and every chair, something like that. Okay. Or you would state it like, if it's a chair, it's an impermanent phenomena. So everything that, yeah, is a chair, it's referring to, and that quality of impermanent, distributive means it distributes to all the members of the group. Okay. Then he had this little section about a table and a chair, which, you know, may or may not have gotten you confused. Okay, so a table and a chair are impermanent phenomena. So far, so good. Okay. Yeah. Is a table and a chair a table and a chair? Usually we say everything is itself. A chair is a chair. A TV is a TV. Is a table and a chair a table and a chair? No. No, why not?
There isn't something that is the two. There isn't an example of something that is the two.
Yeah. But unpack that. Why?
There isn't something that is
the two.
The two, a table and a chair.
Right. But how come you can't say a table and a chair is a table and a chair?
Because a table and a chair is not a table, and a table and a chair is not a chair.
Yeah. So why can't they be a table and a chair?
There is nothing that is the two, table and chair.
Yeah. If it's not a table, and if it's not a chair, then it can't be both a table and a chair. Okay. So that's relating, you know, when we do the, let's say the refutation, the diamond slivers, something is not produced by self, by others, by both, by neither. So the one of both there, why you can't say it's both, because if it's not produced by self and it's not produced by other, then it can't be produced by both. Yeah. So it's kind of similar to that. Okay. So you okay about a table and a chair not being a table and a chair? Because a table and a chair, when it's used as a subject, is a whole.
singular.
Huh?
A singular.
Singular.
Yeah, it's like a singular thing, a table and a chair. Yeah. We're not seeing it as a table and a chair. It's a table and a chair. One thing. Yeah?
I think it would be helpful to put quotation marks around a table and a chair so that it conveys that it's one entity.
Yeah.
That's what we usually do, but I guess this book does not follow that convention.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that could make it clearer. But it's asking us to be sharper and pick this out, because even though it's not how we would say it in English, this is more how things are working in terms of debate.
So you could put any two objects as a singular collective. An apple and a tree,
yeah,
is not an apple and a tree.
Right.
A star and a person is not a star and a person.
Right. Because a star and a person is not a person. And a star and a person is not a star. Okay. So if it's not either of those, it can't be both of them. Okay. Okay. Then there was, his discussion of maybe said. Let's see if I can. Okay. So there's one section here. In the end, I think this sort of statement should apply only to existence. A chair has the quality of being an impermanent phenomena, but the horn of a rabbit does not have the quality of being a non-existent, because the horn of a rabbit does not have any qualities. Okay? Something that does not exist does not have any qualities. Okay? So you can't say a rabbit horn is pink, because the rabbit horn doesn't exist, so it can't have any qualities. But you can say, you know, because he's talking about the linking verb here, which is usually is, that you can say that the horn of a rabbit may be said to be a non-existent. Okay. So what that is it's a fancy way of, you can't really make any statements of quality about a rabbit's horn, but even to say a rabbit's horn is non-existent, because it's non-existent, so it can't even have the quality of being non-existent. But you can say the horn of a rabbit may be said to be a non-existent. Okay, so that's how you get around it. Yeah. I didn't go through that, so I'm going through it now. Yeah. Okay. So, wait a minute, he's saying something different here. Even though the horn of a rabbit does not have any qualities, it is suitable to say the horn of a rabbit may be said to be a non-existent. It is suitable to say anything about the horn of a rabbit, though it is non-existent. That's contradicting what he before. And so he says, this backs off a little from the earlier explanation of the linking verb required by statements of qualities. But don't throw out P has the quality of being a Q, because it works predominantly. To gloss the linking verb as may be said to be is very weak, defensible but weak. It could be seen as suggesting some sort of nihilism. Still, it should be okay to use it in reference to things we know are non-existent. So he's not even sure himself. Okay? Yeah. The subject is always a concrete or abstract singular. Okay, so it is best to use the indefinite article a or an in both parts of the sentence when possible. This is just better English. It may take some mental force to hear a chair is a material phenomenon and keep in mind that the subject is understood as an abstract singular. But it is always better to use normal language when possible. But it is not always possible. Okay. Remember that above I gave definition as an example of something that is not an exemplifier of itself. Yeah, this is because definition in and of itself, the collective entity definition, is not a definition, but is a definiendum, something that is defined. Okay, so the definiendum is the thing that is defined. The definition is the actual object. Yeah. And then he says, it is probably correct to say that a definition is a definition. Probably. Yeah, in the sense that, you know, you want to be able to say everything is itself. Okay. That is sort of irresistible because whatever qualifies as a definition must be a definition. Okay. Like a chair is a chair. Okay. A definition is a definition. Everything that's a definition is a definition. Okay. So he's saying that should be okay. However, definition itself is not a definition because it is something that is defined. Because you could say, somebody could say, what is a definition? And then somebody else would say, it's, they have a specific Buddhist definition, a triply qualified substantial existent, whatever in the world that means, you know. But we would probably give our, what would we say in English? A definition explains what the object is or something like that. You know, it's a set of words explaining what the object is. Or somebody can look it up in the dictionary right now. Okay, and we would say that's what a definition is. Okay. So, however, definition itself is not a definition because it is something to be defined, which means it's a definiendum, the object to be defined. Thus, to point out that a definition is a definition does not say anything about the collective whole, definition in and of itself. Because definition itself is not a definition. Okay. It's like we were talking last week, empty set is not an empty set because there's many things that are empty sets that belong to the category of empty set. Okay. So, you know, what's an example of an empty set?
Purple terms.
No, I think we would have to use a table and a chair. Yeah, because a set is usually more than one thing, isn't it? Or would you say purple turtles is a set? Everything that is a purple turtle. Yeah, maybe you could do that. Yeah.
What's the definition of definition?
Yeah, we're getting. Okay. Oh, you have a definition? Yeah. Yes. Okay. Okay. Oh, so we have two definitions.
Yes.
Yeah, of definition.
So the first one is the one that we're thinking about, a statement of the exact meaning of a word, especially in a dictionary. Mm-hmm. The other one is the degree of distinctness in outline of an object, image, or sound, especially of an image in a photograph or on a screen. So the definition, the sharpness, the
yeah.
Second one.
Yeah. Okay, so we would use the first one. Okay. So you're saying even in English, the You know, the definition of definition is different than the definition of definition in Buddhist language. Okay. So what he's saying here is that, he's saying in English, we could say a definition is a definition in the sense of everything is itself. But when you want to show that definition is not actually a definition, then you wouldn't say a definition is, not a definition. You would just use definition without the article in there when you're speaking about definition, that is the definition meaning a definiendum. Okay, you would leave out the article in that case. So generally, thus to point out that a definition is a definition does not say anything about the collective whole, because definition in and of itself is not a definition. So sometimes the indefinite article, for example, A, before the subject has to be dropped in order to express the meaning correctly. Okay, so we might say an empty set is an empty set, but empty set is not empty set. Okay, so how does this work? The two players here are definition and definiendum, literally meaning the thing defined. Generally, we think of a definition as a string of words that describe something, identifying the essential characteristics of that thing. That's the dictionary definition. Many people are not familiar with the word definiendum, but you can tell from the structure of the word is derived from Latin. That, of course, everybody studied in high school, unless they could get out of it. Like me, as derived from Latin, that it refers to that which is defined. So that's what a definiendum is, that which is defined. So we tend to think of both of these as words. However, in the Buddhist system, the definition is the actual object, and the definiendum is the name designated to that object. The definition is not just a word or string of words, not a mere description, but the object itself. For instance, the definition of a phenomena is that which holds its own entity. Thus, what this means is that the Buddhists are saying this is the essential characteristic of a phenomena. This does not mean that it is a string of words describing the character of a phenomena, but that all of those things that have the character of holding their own entities are suitable to be called phenomena. Okay? So you can see here the Buddhist way of thinking about definition and definiendum is a little bit different than our way. Okay? We usually think definiendum is the object, and definition is a bunch of words describing the object. Okay, but in Buddhism, definiendum is just the shortcut term, and the definition is the actual object. Okay, so the definition is the actual thing. And for the sake of convenience, we designate that which holds its entity with the name phenomena. Thus, the way we understand a term is by first becoming familiar with actual objects that illustrate its definition. Only then may we understand the definiendum. Only then may we understand the definiendum, the mere conventionality, the handy name that we use to designate those sorts of objects, things that hold their own entities, and so forth. Okay, so, for example, if we have the definiendum cat, yeah, the definition might be what a four. What's the definition of a cat?
Four-legged
furry. For a four-legged
furry man.
That purrs.
No. Yeah, that says meow. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. A four-legged furry thing that has attractive. Yeah. But it's difficult because when we say cat, do we mean a house cat, a pet cat, or do we refer to cat that would include lions and tigers?
It says that it is a small, domesticated, carnivorous mammal with soft fur, a short snout, and retractable claws. It is widely kept as a pet or for catching mice, and many breeds have been developed.
Okay, so.
It's a domesticated, carnivorous mammal.
A domesticated carnivorous mammal with retractable claws.
Soft fur and a short snout.
Short fur and a soft snout. Because otherwise, if you don't add those other things, you could be talking about a dog. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or a
mouse. Yeah, well, yeah, some people have domesticated mice. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the way we understand the term cat is by first becoming familiar with the actual objects that illustrate its definition. Yeah. So somebody's saying, hey, that's a cat, and that's a cat, and that's a cat. And becoming familiar with those, then we begin to, you know, all those objects that are illustrations of the definition, then we come to understand what the definiendum cat means. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, you know, we usually think in English you start out with the word and then the definition follows. But this is saying, no, first there's the actual objects that are the definition or that are illustrations of the definition. And we attach a name to that for convenience sake. Yeah, so it's a whole different way of looking at things, isn't it? Yeah, and you can see that our usual way of looking at things is very much based on inherent existence. Yeah, there are these external things out there, and then we give them definitions. Rather than there are things that have similar qualities, and our mind puts them together to form a class, and then we give one name to that category or class of things. Yeah, so it's a whole different way of looking at things. You can see how grasping at inherent existence comes about in here. Next, understand that a definition is not in turn defined. Okay, that is, there is no definition of any particular definition. So there's no definition of a small mammal, the domesticated animal with retractable claws and a small snout and that purrs sometimes. Okay. So there's no definition of that. That is the definition of a cat. Okay, so the character of a thing is its character, and nothing more defines it. Definitions may be described or explained, so we may unpack a definition and what it means, but they are not defined by their own definitions. Okay, but definition in general is a definiendum. Okay, and definition in general has a definition, which we're coming to. Though any particular definition is never defined in turn, this is not true of definition in and of itself. For definition in and of itself is not a definition, but a definiendum. This is so because there is a definition of definition. For definition is defined as that which is a triply qualified substantial existent. That's according to the Sautantrika school. Okay, others would not define a definition that way. So a definition is called substantial existent because it is the actual object, the meaning or referent of its definiendum. But definition itself is not a definition, but a definiendum. Okay, you understand that, right? In order to mark that clearly, the subject is stated without an article. So definition is a definiendum. Yeah, empty set is an empty set. Okay. And definition is not a definition because definition in and of itself is a definiendum.
Empty set is not an empty set.
Well, an empty set
is an empty set,
but empty set is not an empty set. Yeah. Okay. Thus, sometimes the indefinite article A or an must be left out of the subject in order to alert the reader to the fact that the subject can only be understood as the abstract singular, the thing in and of itself, even though including the indefinite article would be more grammatical English. Okay, so what he's saying is, in order to make the Buddhist approach to these things work, sometimes it's not going to be good English, but mostly we should try and make it so it's good English. Okay, this doesn't. Okay, he says this does not mean we need to speak Tibinglish now, English spoken in the mold of Tibetan, which does not typically use indefinite articles. That's what's interesting about Tibetan language. There's no a, an, or an, and there's no the. Yeah. And in English, you know, a and the have very different meanings, don't they? The means that one, something specific. A usually means, you know, it's the abstract singular. Okay. But the Tibetans don't have either a or the. So you have to pick up from the context what's going on. Rather, we should always try to use ordinary English when possible and bear in mind how statements of qualities are understood in the system. What's more, the way the statements are understood is not that unusual once you get used to it. Okay. Of course, though everything that exists is a common locus of multiple qualities, nothing is a common locus of all qualities. Common locus means you have different sets of things or different categories of things, and common locus means it's something that belongs to, you know, if it's a common locus between cat and mammal, you know, you could, somebody says, what's a common locus between cat and mammal? You can say Maitri or Karuna, okay, because both a camel and a mat. Okay. Yeah, that's the like the election between Gush and Boar. Yeah. Okay. So something that's both a, you know, a cat and a mammal. Yeah. So that's what common locus means. Okay. So nothing is a common locus of all qualities. Yeah. Thus, some statements of qualities are negative. Okay, here's some examples. P is not a Q. Professor Perdue is not British. P does not have the quality of being a Q. Professor Perdue does not have the quality of being British. Definition does not have the quality of being a definition. For these is not or are not statements, it is suitable to consider the meaning of the linking verb to be, or to mean, the linking verb to be does not have the quality of being, or does not have the nature of being. Okay, so when we're saying is, it means does not have the quality of being. Or does not have the nature of being. Yeah, because the word is, you know, is tricky. Yeah, because in English we would say a white horse is white. Yeah, a white horse has the quality of being white. Okay, but that doesn't work here. But he's saying that for it's for the negative statements that it means it would be does not have the quality of being. So a cat is not an elephant. A cat does not have the quality of being an elephant. The cat does not have the nature of being an elephant. Okay? So especially when it's in the negative, it can mean does not have the quality. Even for non-existents, which do not have any qualities at all, a statement denying it has such and such quality works. Thus, the horn of a rabbit does not have the quality of being an existent. Okay, so here we can say things about whether you can say a horn of a rabbit has qualities or not, yeah, some people might say, no, it doesn't exist. How can it have qualities? And another person can say it doesn't exist, so you can say anything you want about it. Horn of a rabbit is pink, horn of a rabbit is purple.
And you say that the horn of a rabbit does not have the quality of being non-existent in that case?
Does not have the quality of being non-existent. No, because it does have the quality of being non-existent.
Do they have qualities? Or huh? I'm just confused. non-existents don't have any qualities at all. So then anything you say is not a quality, I would think.
Yeah, so it seemed like you couldn't say anything at all about non-existents, even saying that they're a non-existent. But it looks like maybe you can, but it sounds, it's strange, isn't it, to think of something that is non-existent as having the quality of being non-existent. Yeah, maybe that's its only quality, doesn't have the quality of being pink or purple. In sum, in the collected topics tradition of Buddhist debate, for a statement of qualities, and here he's summarizing, okay, one, the subject is either a concrete singular, which is, what's an example of what's a concrete singular?
The bookcase.
Okay, that's an example, but how would you describe a concrete singular?
It's a subject that's not in front of you that you're speaking on.
No, it's a specific subject.
Oh, you're talking about concrete.
A concrete singular is a specific thing that is the subject. For example,
the bone.
The chair.
The chair?
This clock on the table.
This clock on the table. This chair. Okay. So it must be either a concrete singular when the statement is about something clear and concrete, like the White House or my favorite chair, or is an abstract singular. So what's an abstract singular? That's an example of an abstract singular. What is it? Tell me, give me a description or a definition of an abstract singular.
That's what I just tried to describe.
Yeah. A singular object that isn't referring to a specific thing. Yeah, a concrete specific thing. Okay. This is what I said at the beginning of the class. Okay. So, and then two, the predication is always collective, never distributed. So what's collective predication?
The collective predication is not a part of the object, it's the whole.
Yeah, it's applying to the entire whole object. Okay. And what's a distributive predication?
The predicate applies to each and everything that is the subject.
Okay. Okay. You got that? Okay. So the predication is always collective, never distributive. The qualities of a phenomena as a singular entity may be distinct from the qualities of the illustrations of that phenomenon in the way that definition itself is a definiendum, but no definition is a definiendum. Don't you love it? Definition itself, just referring to the abstract definition, itself is a definiendum. But no particular definition is a definiendum, because a particular definition is a definition. Okay. It is easier to understand the collective whole, the thing in and of itself, when the subject is a concrete singular thing, like a chair in the room. But trying to understand the nature of an abstract singular subject is important too. The issue of the nature of the subject goes to questions of generalities or universals. The basis of designation of phenomena in consideration of the selflessness of phenomena in Buddhism, and so on. What kind of sentence is that? The issue, who was his editor? The issue of the nature of the subject, okay, so what the subject is, goes to questions of generalities or universals, okay, which are referring to a generality of an object. The basis of designation of phenomena in a consideration of the selflessness of phenomena in Buddhism. Now, is that an appositive or is that another noun? In that sentence, the nature of the subject goes to the basis of designation. Anyway, however, yeah, I want to talk to his editor. My editor would have pink and purple and red all around that sentence. Okay. However, we cannot sort out everything up front. That's true. Rather, it is best, because he brings in generalities here and doesn't tell you what they are. Yeah. Rather, it is best to figure out a rational procedure and then use that to settle questions. For our philosopher friends, let your epistemology inform your ontology, not the other way around.
Sure.
Yes, sir. We'll do that. Could you say it in English, please? Okay. So he's writing for an audience who, you know, philosophers too. Okay. Still, we do know these things about how the abstract singular subject is considered in the collected topic system. Okay, so here's some things about how the abstract singular object. Okay, one, if anything in the subject is existent, then the subject is existent. Okay, so for example, the selfless, which takes in all existence and non-existence, is itself existent because among the things that may be properly referred to as selfless, there are existent things. In the same way, the pair, a chair and a horn of a rabbit, is existent simply because part of that pair is existent. Even though there's nothing that is the two of them. Okay. And then two, if anything in the subject is permanent, then the subject is permanent. For instance, existence itself includes all permanent and all impermanent phenomena. And for this reason, existence itself is considered to be permanent. This has to be because in order to understand existent as a whole, one must understand that permanent factor. But you should always understand the impermanent factor too. Okay, so this is just some rules that they have in collected topics that if a category, here meaning they would might call it a universal or a generality, so it's, you know, like a category. If that category, like existent, has members, things that are part of that category, and as long as it has one thing that is actually existent in that category, then that whole category is existent. Okay? Or if that, so in other words, existent trumps non-existence. Okay? Then also, if in a category like existence, there's some things are permanent and some things are impermanent, then the whole category becomes permanent. Okay, so here, permanent trumps impermanent. Don't ask me why. Okay, maybe because emptiness is permanent. Yeah. Okay, so it's just some rules of the game that when you're referring to something that is a generality that has many members, yeah, that existent trumps non-existence and permanent trumps impermanent. That's just the rules they made up. Okay? So if somebody says, okay, the selfless, yeah? Is the selfless permanent or impermanent?
Permanent.
Permanent. Why?
Because it contains permanent.
It doesn't change. And
it contains at least one permanent phenomenon.
For example?
The clock on the wall.
The clock on the wall is permanent?
Oh, not the clock on the wall, sorry. Space.
Yeah, you have to say in uncompounded space. Yes. Okay. Okay, what about, what about the category phenomena? Is that permanent or impermanent?
Permanent.
Why?
Because it also has permanent members.
Such as?
Emptiness.
Okay, such as emptiness. How about phenomena? Is it existent or non-existent?
Existent.
Existent. Why?
Because non-existents are not phenomena. They're not objects of knowledge.
Okay.
They're not suitable to be known by an awareness.
Yeah. Okay.
Even if they were, it would be existent because it contains existent memories.
Yeah, but you can't say even if it were when it's not.
Right.
That's like saying, even if Trump were intelligent. You know, why, sorry. Even if, you know.
If it contains one existent, it's existent.
Yes, okay. Yeah. So, sorry, I have to have some humor in here sometimes, you know? Otherwise, it's just. Yeah. Okay. So these two points are based on the consideration of what is in the subject. These points do not mean that the subject is being thought of distributively, but that the nature of the subject and the possible ways to perceive it are influenced by what is meant by the subjects collectively. Okay, these points do not mean that the subject is being thought of distributively, okay, but that the nature of the subject, that general category, and the possible ways to perceive it, what does that mean? Whatever it means, are influenced by what is meant by the subject collectively. Does anybody understand this, or is it just me? Yeah.
I can't say I understand it, but I can tell you what the problem is.
Okay. Yes.
I've thought about this for a long time, and Geshe Dadwo hasn't, because I didn't remember the first year, he wouldn't answer me this year, so I'm still confused. So this goes back to, what is this subject collectively? What is the abstract singular? So I found that in this, and I can't see that they answer it, but in the original debate book on page 789 in the PDF.
I don't think the abstract singular is the subject collectively. It's a generality. Anyway, go on. Yeah, go on.
Okay. Well, here's what I see is the basic issue is, if you were talking about the abstract singular subject, and it was a pot, does that pot hold water or not?
A pot.
The abstract singular pot.
Yes.
Does it hold water or not? That's what the question I can never answer.
I see.
They have this thing where they explain it, but I still don't think I have any idea what it's saying.
Okay.
It's two paragraphs. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
Okay.
What are you reading from?
It's from the debate book. When he speaks in his own language, not translating anything, his conclusion at the whole end of the book, he goes, the pressing question that remains is, what is the nature of the abstract singular pot that is the subject of this assertion?
Okay.
Of course, many things have been said about the nature of this subject. It is an object of knowledge. It is an impermanent phenomena. It is matter. Matter. An abstract singular pot is matter. So it is able to perform the function of holding water. It is a pot.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time with that.
Yeah. I don't think that's referring to the generality pot. It's just the abstract singular pot that's not referring to a particular pot.
Yeah, that's confusing to me.
Yeah.
Really confusing to me. And I don't understand, what's the difference between what we're talking about there and the generality?
The generality would be pot, yeah, which would be like the generality, and the members of that generality, the particulars, would be a gold pot and a flat pot and your pot and my pot.
Yeah, so
Whereas I don't know that the singular abstract is being used as as a generality.
I still can't tell the part because, okay, then it goes on. Pot, in this sentence, does not refer to each and every pot. And in a sense, neither does it refer to the collection of all pots as a gross gathering of all pots in existence.
Uh-huh.
We've kind of covered that in this class.
Yeah.
Also here, pot does not refer to the idea of a pot, which we've...
Right.
That's a mental abstraction.
Yeah.
It is an appearing object of a thought consciousness and a permanent phenomena. Mm-hmm. But it still holds water and is matter. See, this is so...
That
rather, in this type of sentence, pot
sense,
refers to pot as such, not taken as a whole, but as the singular generality.
I think like you have to ask Dan Perdue. I mean, you can't say that it's a permanent thing that it also...
Maybe I read it wrong. Pot, in this sentence, does not refer to each and every pot, and in a sense, does... And in a sense, neither does it refer to the collection of all pots as a gross gathering of all pots in existence. Also, here, pot does not refer to the idea of a pot, for an idea as a mental abstraction is an appearing object of a thought consciousness and a permanent phenomenon. Okay, I mixed that up.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea thing.
Yeah.
Rather, in this type of sentence, pot refers to pot as such, taken not as a whole, but as the singular generality. The qualities of a phenomena as a singular entity may be distinct from the qualities of the illustrations of that phenomena. For instance, pot is a generality of a gold pot, but an illustration of pot, such as a bulbous flat base phenomena, which is made from gold and is able to perform the function of holding water, is not a generality of a gold pot. So I still can't really answer my question. I guess it's saying that the singular, abstract singular pot is matter, does hold water, but you can't point one out.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like that, doesn't it? Because it's abstract.
Whatever.
Yeah. Okay, so we're at a breaking point. Are there some more questions?
Yes.
Only ones I can answer.
Okay. Okay, I want to go back to where you started tonight. What was how afflictions and non-virtuous mental factors compare?
Uh-huh.
And then when you talked about what is an affliction but not a non-virtuous mental factor, and we gave the examples of self-grasps being ignorance, mm-hmm. and the view of a personal identity, because mm-hmm. both of those are neutral. Mm-hmm. So this is where I haven't cleared this up in my mind yet. So when you're at the eighth bhumi, you don't have self-grasping ignorance.
Right.
You don't have the view of the personal identity.
Right.
You have cognitive obscurations.
Right.
Do you have any kind of ignorance? What is it called, like a non-afflictive ignorance? Or?
It's called the latencies of ignorance.
Oh, just the latencies.
But the latencies of ignorance are not ignorance.
It's not what?
Ignorance. The latencies of ignorance is not ignorance. The smell of the onions is not an onion.
Thank you. Yes, I found it interesting, Venerable, the comment you made earlier about the no A or the in Tibetan.
About the
no A. About
no
the
A,
articles
yeah.
mm-hmm. in Tibetan. It's very similar in Japanese, Korean, and other Eastern languages. I was wondering, from different families, I wonder if that's influenced by Buddhism. And also, the style of translation into English, I've heard some people call it hybrid Buddhist English after hybrid Buddhist Sanskrit.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's always whenever you translate, because words and language are reflective of concepts, and concepts are reflective of culture. So whenever you're translating something, you're trying to translate a whole idea that may or may not be present in one culture or another, in the sense that, like they say, Eskimos have how many words for snow? Yeah, many, many words for snow. And they can tell the difference between all these different kinds of things. Whereas we look at it and we just say snow and it all looks the same. Yeah. So, you know, language, conceptuality, it depends a lot on culture. Yeah. And we can see, you know, how we think also has something to do with the number of word, like for anger, we have so many different kinds of words that fall under anger. Yeah, other cultures probably don't have so many different kinds of anger as we do. Yeah, that says something about, yeah, about the culture. But, you know, even like when they've been translating, what Geshe Dadol is involved with, translating science into Tibetan, you know, it's very difficult because there's scientific ideas where you have no, you know, similar kind of idea or word in Tibetan. Like for atom, you know, like, They have a word for partless particle. Yeah. But that's not really an atom. And then within the atom, electron and neutron and proton and all these other things, you know, there's no such word. And in fact, you know, what they've learned is the four elements. And they see everything in terms of the four elements. And then, you know, we come in with our periodic chart, you know? And they're going, what in the world is this? Okay, so it's a whole different way of looking at things.
I think it's very interesting how words and language influence how we perceive reality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at some point, words were constructed based on, you know, quote-unquote reality, but then, you know, they're then taught to others who may not have experienced the same things, and then the person who has been taught this concept will perceive the world around them in that way.
Yeah.
That's like how culture is transmitted. So it's an example of how there's no inherent existence out there. It's just learned.
Yeah, and how subjective words are. And how our idea that the definiendum is the object is not correct. Yeah. The definiendum is just the, you know, the name that's given to something. Mm-hmm.
Changing the topic. I'm finding it very easy to have compassion for the kids who have to take this class and take a final on it. Like, this whole time I've been imagining like a weekly quiz about this chapter in particular.
So bad in school right now. But what you'll see as you go on, if you persevere with this, especially, you know, thinking about the pervasions we're coming into that, is that it really teaches you to think in a very clear way. Yeah? And so it's very useful in that way. You know? And especially, you know, when you set up a syllogism that it has to be done in a certain way to be a correct syllogism. And then we begin to see that a lot of the ways we think are totally off the wall. They're not correct syllogisms at all. Yeah. And that we don't think in a rational, logical way. We just make mush. Yeah. So it's very helpful, I think, for clarifying our thoughts. Even though the weekly quiz may drive you crazy.
I'm imagining a question like, is the definition of definiendum?
Yeah.
Like, is the definition of a definition of a definition?
True or false?
Let's hope it's just like a final year in Cambridge about syllogism you made.
Yeah. Okay. So let's, shall we stop here rather than go into privations? Should we start a little bit on privations? Let's do a little bit. Okay, so statements of privation. In this system of debate and reasoning, statements of qualities are never intended to say something distributively about a subject, about each and every occurrence of that subject. On the other hand, statements of privation always say something distributively about each and every occurrence of a phenomena. Okay. The word privation is a time-honored translation of the Sanskrit vyapti and the Tibetan kyapa. These words convey the sense that something is spread throughout, covered by, filled with, completely occupied by, or universally penetrated by another thing or quality. It is used to state that every member of a group of phenomena is completely occupied by some quality. For instance, here is a statement of privation. Whatever is a material phenomena is necessarily impermanent. Okay, so that's meaning that every single thing that's a material phenomena is impermanent. Okay, another way of saying that, which I actually prefer, is if it's a material phenomena, it is necessarily impermanent. It's the same meaning. Okay. This statement means that spread throughout the group of material phenomena is the quality of being impermanent, that the entire group of material phenomena is covered wall to wall, as it were, with impermanence, that the entire group is filled with impermanent things, that the entire group is fully, completely, universally occupied by impermanent things. Of course, this does not say that each and every impermanent thing is a material phenomena, so the privation doesn't go the other way. Yeah, which would be false, because time, for instance, is impermanent but not material. Okay. You may prefer to think of these as universal statements, but privation is truer to the original words. In this course, there are two main ways of stating a privation. Okay, so here's what he has. Whatever is a P is necessarily a Q. An example, whatever is a cat is necessarily a mammal. Okay. And then the second way, if something is a P, then it is necessarily a Q. An example, if something is a cat, then it is necessarily a mammal. Okay, so the sense of these statements is clear enough. Actually, he includes lions and tigers, if you read further, as cats, which we don't. Yeah. Okay, the second and fourth sentences, whatever is a cat is necessarily a mammal, and if something is a cat, then it is necessarily a mammal. So these sentences state that each and every cat is a mammal. They do not say that every mammal is a cat, which would be false, since dogs are mammals, but they are not cats. So a correct statement of privation always says something about each and every P phenomena, the subject that comes first, the phenomena referred to in the first part of the sentence, the antecedent. As that implies, a correct statement of privation will never say something about some, but not all of the P phenomena. Okay, so when you say if something is a cat, you're talking about all cats, not some cats. Okay, or whatever is a dog means anything that has the nature of being a dog, not just some of them. Okay, to appreciate why these statements are called privations, the statement that whatever is a P is necessarily a Q may be understood as saying that P's are pervaded by being Q's. For example, the statement that all cats are mammals may be understood as saying that cats are pervaded by being animals. Mammals. And animals, too. Okay. For any correct privation, the range of the P phenomenon must be equal to or smaller than the range of the Q phenomenon. Okay, so for existence, there is the correct privation. Whatever is an impermanent phenomena, P, is necessarily a functioning thing. So in those two, impermanent phenomena and functioning things are mutually inclusive. Okay, so when you draw your circles, you have one circle that is both a P and a Q, that's both impermanent phenomena and functioning things. Okay. As you know, these two are mutually inclusive, so it is also the case that whatever is a functioning thing is necessarily an impermanent phenomena. So if they're mutually inclusive, the privation goes both ways. Okay. Thus, in this case, the P phenomena and the Q phenomena are equal in extent. That is, everything that is a P phenomena, impermanent, is a Q phenomena, a functioning thing. And everything that is a Q phenomena, a functioning thing, is a P phenomena, impermanent. For the only other possible correct privation, the range of P phenomena must be smaller than the range of Q phenomena. For instance, there is the privation, whatever is a cat is necessarily a mammal. Okay, so there if you draw it, you know, your bigger circle is mammal and your smaller circle is cat. Yeah, and within it you have four little stars. Okay, so cats and mammals are three possibilities, such that whatever is a cat, P, is necessarily a mammal. But it is not the case that whatever is a mammal is necessarily a cat. So the privation only goes that whatever is a cat is necessarily is a mammal, not the other way around. Thus, the range of the P phenomena, cats, is smaller than the range of the Q phenomena, mammals, because there is at least one thing that is a mammal but not a cat, such as a whale. Okay. These are the only two patterns of privations that can work in an accurate statement of privation. So there's only those two. Privations either have to be two mutually exclusive circles or a small circle inside a big circle. Okay. There is nothing particularly surprising about statements of privation in this system, as opposed to universal statements in other systems. The greatest challenge is in learning to recognize the many ways that people express these sorts of statements in the real world. So here are some. Okay, so he goes into this very often, like all the different ways that people in ordinary language say this. Personally speaking, when I'm studying debate, I find getting into all these other ways of saying it, you know, kind of gets me confused. But it could also clarify it because you just say there's many ways of saying the same thing. Okay? So here's some of them. If something is a P, then it's a Q. If something is a cat, then it's an animal, a mammal. Okay? All P's are Q's. For example, all cats are mammals. Now, that's something in ordinary English that you're likely to hear somebody just say. You know, you would say to a little child, all cats are mammals. You wouldn't say to a little child, if something is a cat, it is necessarily a mammal. Okay? You would just say, all cats are mammals. Okay? Another way of saying it, that something is a P implies that it is a Q. That something is a cat implies that it is a mammal. And he specifies here that implies doesn't mean imply. It means naturally leads to the conclusion, or, you know, like that. So it doesn't mean just imply. That something is a cat implies that it is a mammal. I don't know how often people would say that. P's or Q's, cats or mammals? Yeah, people would say that a lot. A P is a Q, a cat is a mammal. People would say that. Whatever is a P is a Q, whatever is a cat is a mammal. They wouldn't say that so much. Every P is a Q, every cat is a mammal. Yeah? Everything that is a P is also a Q. Everything that is a cat is also a mammal. Yeah, you could say it in English, but it's not so common. For every P, it is a Q. For every cat, it is a mammal. No, it's more, for every cat, there is a comfy bed. You know? Each thing P is such that it is a Q. Each cat is such that it is a mammal. It's just easier to say all cats are mammals, isn't it? It is a Q because it is a P. It is a mammal because it is a cat. We would usually say because it's a cat, it is a mammal, wouldn't we? Yeah. Because, oh, that's the next one. Because it is a P, it is a Q. Because it is a cat, it is a mammal. Each and every P is a Q. Each and every cat is a mammal. So, contrary to public belief that Karuna is a queen of queen of the world, she's actually a mammal. Of course, you know, there, you know, something that's the queen of the world can also be a mammal, can't it? So, anything at all that is a P is also a Q. Anything at all that is a cat is also a mammal. I see our cats chafing. They want to say anything at all that is a cat should also be cherished and fed and pet and whenever it wants, but not when it doesn't want. For every P, it is also a Q. For every cat, it is also a mammal. People wouldn't say that so much. When you have a P, you have a Q. When you have a cat, you have a mammal.
I think if you were arguing, you might say some of these things.
Who?
If you were arguing about something, you might say something.
Yeah, yeah. If you were arguing. It seems that the most prevalent ways of stating a privation in ordinary English are all cats are mammals. Yes, thank you. Every cat is a mammal, and cats are mammals. Okay. But when you're talking in debate language, you would always say, if it is a P, it is necessarily a Q, or whatever is a P is necessarily a Q. Yeah, you usually use that. Okay, shall we stop here? What statements of privation imply? Well, continue next week.